Hi, folks. Welcome to the Smartass Historian. I am, as always, the Great White Snark, Scotty J. And this would be the moment when I would be introducing the Reverend Jeff, but because of the COVID-19 pandemic, which has swept our country and pretty much the world right now, Jeff is at his place and I'm at mine. And until I can, you know, figure out a way to record us over the internet, I'll be going solo for a little bit. So, I got a good show lined up for you today. And for this one, I'm going to dedicate it out to my little buddy, James DeAgostino. Now, James is my friend, is a friend of one of our listeners. And he's fascinated with space. He's fascinated with space travel. As I said before, when we talked about the, Project Mercury? No, Project Gemini. You know, when we were at the Air and Space Museum, James was really excited about looking at the rockets and understanding the planets. So this episode is for him. I'm dedicating it to him. So I hope you have fun when you hear it, bud. Now, as we all know, following the end of World War II, a nuclear arms race evolved between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Now, since the USSR did not have bases in the Western Hemisphere from which to deploy bomber planes, Stalin decided to develop intercontinental ballistic missiles, which created our missile race. Now, the rocket technology in turn enabled both sides to develop Earth-orbiting satellites for communications and gathering weather data and intelligence. Now, Americans were shocked when the Soviet Union placed the first satellite in orbit in October of 57, leading to a growing fear that the U.S. was falling into a missile gap. Now, a month later, the Soviets launched Sputnik 2, carrying a dog into orbit. Though the animal was not recovered alive, it was obvious their goal was human spaceflight. Now, unable to disclose the details of the military space projects, President Eisenhower ordered the creation of a civilian space agency in charge of civilian and scientific space exploration. Now, based on the Federal Research Agency, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, it was named the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. It achieved its first goal, an American satellite in space, in 1958. The next goal was to put a man there. Now, the limit of space, which is also known as the Kármán line, was defined at the time as a... Now, this was defined at that time at a minimum altitude of 62 miles, and the only way to reach it was by using rocket-powered boosters. Well, this created a risk for the pilot, including explosion, high G-forces, and vibrations during liftoff through a dense atmosphere, and temperatures of more than 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit from air compression during re-entry. Now, in space, pilots would require pressurized chambers or spacesuits to supply fresh air. While there, they would experience weightlessness, which could potentially cause disorientation. Further potential risks included radiation and micrometeoroid strikes, both of which would normally be absorbed in the atmosphere. Now, all seemed possible to overcome. Experience from satellites suggested micrometeoroid risks was negligible, and experiments in the early 50s with simulated weightlessness, high G-forces on humans, and sending animals to the limit space all suggested potential problems could be overcome by known technologies. Finally, re-entry was studied using the nuclear warheads of ballistic missiles, which demonstrated a blunt, forward-facing heat shield could solve the problem of heating. Now, the man behind all of this, the first administrator of NASA, was T. Keith Glennon. And with Hugh Dryden, who was the last director of NACA, as his deputy, at the creation of the agency on October 1st of 58. Now, Glennon would report to the president through the National Aeronautics and Space Council. The group responsible for Project Mercury was NASA's Space Task Group, and the goals of the program were to orbit a crewed spacecraft around the Earth, investigate the pilot's ability to function in space, and to recover both pilot and spacecraft safely. Existing technology and off-the-shelf equipment would be used whenever practical. The simplest and most reliable approach to the system design would be followed, and an existing launch vehicle would be employed, together with a progressive test program. Now, space requirements included a launch escape system to separate the spacecraft and the occupant from the launch vehicle in case of an impending failure, attitude control for orientation of the spacecraft in orbit, a retro rocket system to bring the spacecraft out of orbit, drag braking blunt body for atmospheric re-entry, and landing on water. Because Lord knows if you try to land one of those early spacecrafts on land, chances are you would wreck it. Now, to communicate with the spacecraft during an orbital mission, an extensive communication network had to be built. In keeping with his desire to keep from giving the U.S. space program an overly military flavor, Eisenhower at first hesitated to give the project top national priority, which meant that Mercury had to wait in line behind military projects for materials. However, this rating was granted in May of 59, a little more than a year and a half after Sputnik was launched. Now, 12 companies had bid to build the Mercury spacecraft on a $20 million budget or contract. Now, today, that'd be $172 million. In January of 59, McDonnell Aircraft Corporation was chosen to be the primary contractor for the spacecraft. 2 weeks later, Northern American Aviation, which was located in Los Angeles, was awarded contract for Little Joe, a small rocket to be used for development in the launch escape system. The worldwide tracking network for communication between the ground and the spacecraft during flight was awarded to the Western Electric Company. Redstone rockets for suborbital launches were manufactured in Huntsville, Alabama by the Chrysler Corporation, and Atlas rockets by Convair in San Diego, California. Now, for the crew launches, the Atlantic Missile Range at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in Florida was made control center, while the computing center of the communication network was in Goddard Space Center in Maryland. Little Joe rockets were launched from Wallops Island in Virginia. Astronaut training took place at Langley in Virginia, Lewis Flight Propulsion Laboratory in Cleveland, Ohio, and the Naval Air Development Center in Johnsville, in Warminster, Pennsylvania. Now, the Langley wind tunnels, together with a rocket sled tracked at Holman Air Force Base at Alamogordo, New Mexico, were used for the aerodynamic studies. And both the Navy and Air Force aircraft were made available for the development of the spacecraft's landing systems. And Navy ships and the Navy Marine Corps helicopters were made available for recovery. That sounds like a lot of work that went into the Mercury program. But this was our chance to try to get into the space race and beat the Soviets. Our main fear at the time was that the Soviets was going to get to the moon first. And I know this has been used in a lot of scientific or sci-fi movies over the years, but they were going to build a moon base where they could just launch from the moon to attack America. It sounds crazy now, but that was the fear in the 50s. Now, south of Cape Canaveral in the town of Cocoa Beach, boomed. Now, many of you may remember Cocoa Beach from the 1960s television show I Dream of Jeannie. It's where Major Nelson and Major Healy lived and worked out of. They were astronauts. Now, from here, 75,000 people watched the first American orbital flight being launched in 62. Now, NASA announced the following seven astronauts, known as the Mercury 7, on April 9, 1959. Now, I'm going to give you the ranks at the time that they were announced. Lieutenant Scott Carpenter, Captain Gordon Cooper, Major John H. Glenn, John Glenn Jr., Captain Virgil Grissom, Lieutenant Commander Walter M. Shearer, Lieutenant Commander Alan Shepard Jr., and Major Donald K. Slate. Now, all of them, let's see, for the most part, okay, let's see, Scott Carpenter, Commander, sorry, see, we have two from the Navy, 1, 2, 3 from the Air Force, 1 from the Marine, okay, wait, 1, 2, 3 from the Navy, 3 from the Air Force, and 1 from the Marine Corps. I guess we had to toss the Marine Corps a bone for something. Now, Shepard became the first American in space by making a suborbital flight in May of 61. He went on to fly the Apollo program and became the only Mercury astronaut to walk on the moon. Gus Grissom, who became the second American in space, also participated in the Gemini and Apollo programs, but died in January of 67 during a pre-launch test for Apollo 1. Glenn became the first American to orbit the Earth in February of 62, then quit NASA and went into politics, serving as a U.S. Senator from 74 to 99, and returned to space in 98 as a payload specialist aboard STS-95. Deke Slayton was grounded in 62, but remained with NASA and was appointed chief astronaut at the beginning of Project Gemini. He remained in the position of senior astronaut in charge of space crew flight assignments, among many other responsibilities, until towards the end of Project Apollo, when he resigned and began training to fly on the Apollo Soyuz test project in 75, which he successfully did. Gordon Cooper became the last to fly in Mercury and made its longest flight, and also flew a Gemini mission. Carpenter's Mercury flight was his only trip into space. Shearer flew the third orbital Mercury mission and then flew a Gemini mission. 3 years later, he commanded the first crewed Apollo mission, becoming the only person to fly in all three of the programs. Now, one of the astronauts' tasks was publicity, and they gave interviews to the press and visited project manufacturing facilities to speak with those who worked on Project Mercury. To make their travels easier, they requested and got jet fighters for personal use. Hey, I mean, these guys were all pilots, so, what better way to zip across the country than in your own personal jet fighter? Now, the press was especially fond of John Glenn, who was considered the best speaker of the seven. They sold their personal stories to Life magazine, which portrayed them as patriotic, God-fearing family men. Life was also allowed to be at home with the families while the astronauts were in space. Now, during the project, Grissom, Carpenter, Cooper, Shearer, and Slayton stayed with their families at or near Langley Air Force Base. Glenn lived at the base and visited his family in D.C. on weekends. Shepard lived with his family at the Naval Air Station Oceana in Virginia. Other than Grissom, who was killed in the 67 Apollo 1 fire, the other six survived past retirement and died between 1993 and 2016. On April 12, 1961, the Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin became the first person in space on an orbital flight. Shepard became the first American in space on a suborbital flight 3 weeks later on May 5th. Glenn, the third Mercury astronaut to fly, became the first American to reach orbit on February 2, 1962, but only after the Soviets had launched a second cosmonaut, German Titov, into a day-long flight in August of 61. Three more Mercury orbital flights were made, ending on May 16, 1963, with the day-long 22-orbit flight. However, the Soviets ended the Vostok program the next month, with the human spaceflight endurance record set by the 82-orbit, almost five-day Vostok 5 flight. Now, all of the six crewed Mercury flights were successful, though some planned flights were canceled during the project. The main medical problems encountered were simple personal hygiene and post-flight symptoms of low blood pressure. The launch vehicles have been tested through uncrewed flights, therefore the numbering of crewed missions did not start with one. Also, there were two separately numbered series, MR for Mercury Redstone, which were suborbital, and MA Mercury Atlas for orbital. These names are not popularly used, since the astronauts followed a pilot tradition of giving each of their spacecraft a name. They selected names ending with a 7 to commemorate the 7 astronauts. Now, times given are universal coordinate time located plus 5 hours. So Mercury Atlas and Mercury Redstone, you can look up all this information. I mean, it's very, like Mercury 3, Mercury Redstone 3 was Freedom 7. Mercury Redstone 4 was Liberty Bell 7. There was Friendship 7, Aurora 7, Sigma 7, Faith 7. And the 20 uncrewed flights used Little Joe, Redstone, and Atlas launch vehicles. Now, they were used to develop the launch vehicles, launch escape system, spacecraft, and tracking network. One flight of a scout rocket attempted to launch a satellite for testing the ground tracking network, but failed to reach orbit. The Little Joe program used 7 airframes for 8 flights, of which 3 were successful. The second Little Joe flight was named Little Joe 6 because it was inserted into the program after the first 5 A-frames had been allocated. And, there's people who study this who are, really deep into NASA history and our Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo programs. And I was not born during the time of this, so I knew a little bit of it. And so you go to the Air and Space Museum in D.C., and they've got a wonderful collection of the rockets and patches from the program. The Adler Planetarium here in Chicago has some of the Gemini and Mercury stuff on display, and none of the Apollo. I wish they had some Apollo, but I did get to see some of the Apollo stuff in D.C. So if you really get a chance, check that stuff out. It's fantastic. But we are going to wrap up this one up. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you all are playing it safe out there. Maintain your social distancing, blah blah blah. You probably heard it all by now. But if you're looking for us out there, we're on Anchor, all major podcasting apps, and Apple Podcast. Got the Facebook pages. Join us there. And for the smartass historian. I'm Scotty J. Catch y'all later, folks.